something, but then another of those lightning flashes hit me. It was just as bright as the one that had lit up my brain when Ivy Templeton had said that her neighbors across the street could see into her living room. "George, your mouth is open. The view is good, but not appetizing." "I could make time," I said, "if you could talk Ellie Dougherty into one condition." He got up and snapped off the TV without a single glance, although the fighting between Duke Wayne and the Pawnee Nation had now reached the critical point, with Fort Hollywood burning merry hell in the background. "Name it." I named it, then said, "I've got to talk to Sadie right now." She was solemn at first. Then she began to smile. The smile became a grin, and when I told her the idea that had come to me at the end of my conversation with Deke, she threw her arms around me. But that wasn't good enough for her, so she climbed until she could wrap her legs around me as well. There was no broom between us that day. "It's brilliant. You're a genius. Will you write the script?" "You bet. It won't take long either." Corny old jokes were already flying around in my head. "Coach Borman looked at the orange juice for 20 minutes because the can said, 'Concentrate!' Our dog had an ingrown tail. We had to x-ray him to find out if he was happy. I rode on a plane so old that one restroom was marked Orville and the other was marked Wilbert. But I need plenty of help with other stuff. What it comes down to is I need a producer. I'm hoping you'll take the job."
"Sure."
She slipped back to the floor with her body still pressed against mine. This produced a regrettably brief flash of bare leg as her skirt pulled up. She began to pace her living room, smoking furiously. She tripped over the easy chair for probably the sixth or eighth time since we'd been on intimate terms, and caught her balance without even seeming to notice, although she was going to have a pretty fine bruise on her shin by nightfall. "If you're thinking 20-star flapper stuff, I can get Joe Pete to run up the costumes." Joe was the new head of the home ec department, having succeeded to the position when Ellen Dougherty was confirmed as principal.
"That's great!
Most of the home ec girls love to sew.
And to cook! George, we'll need to serve evening meals, won't we? If the rehearsals run extra long, and they will, because we're starting awfully late."
"Yes, but just sandwiches."
"Oh, we can do better than that. Lots. And music. We'll need music. It'll have to be recorded because the band could never pull a thing like this together in time."
And then together we said, "Donald Bellingham," in perfect harmony. "What about advertising?" I asked. We were starting to sound like Mickey Rooney and Judy Garland getting ready to put on a show in Aunt Millie's barn.
"Carl Jacoby and his graphic design kids. Posters not just here, but all over town, because we want the whole town to come, not just the relatives of the kids in the show. Standing room only."
"Bingo," I said, and kissed her nose. I loved her excitement. I was getting pretty excited myself.
"What do we say about the benefit aspect?" Sadie asked.
"Nothing, until we're sure we can make enough money. We don't want to raise any false hopes. What do you think about taking a run to Dallas with me tomorrow and asking some questions?"
"Tomorrow's Sunday, hon." "After school on Monday, maybe even before it's out, if you can get period 7 free."
"I'll get Deke to come out of retirement and cover remedial English," I said. "He owes me."
Sadie and I went to Dallas on Monday, driving fast to get there before the close of business hours. The office we were looking for turned out to be on Harry Hines Boulevard, not far from Parkland Memorial. There we asked a bushel of questions, and Sadie gave a brief demonstration of what we were after. The answers were more than satisfactory, and 2 days later I began my second-to-last showbiz venture as director of Jody Jamboree, an all-new, all-hilarious vaudeville song and dance show, and all to benefit a good cause. We didn't say what that cause was, and nobody asked. Two things about the land of a go. There's a lot less paperwork and a hell of a lot more trust. Everybody in town did turn out, and Deke Simmons was right about one thing. Those lame jokes never seemed to get old, not 1,500 miles from Broadway, at least. In the persons of Jim Ledoux, who wasn't bad and could actually sing a little, and Mike Koslaw, who was flat-out hilarious, our show was more Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis than Mr. Bones or Mr. Tambo. The skits were of the knockabout type, and with a couple of athletes to perform them, they worked better than they probably had a right to. In the audience, knees were slapped and buttons were busted. Probably a few girdles were popped as well. Ellen Dougherty dragged her banjo out of retirement. For a lady with blue hair, she played a mean breakdown. And there was Hoochie Coo after all. Mike and Jim persuaded the rest of the football team to perform a spirited can-can, wearing petticoats and bloomers down south and nothing but skin up north. Joe Pete found wigs for them and they stopped the show. The town ladies seemed especially crazy about those bare-chested young men, wigs and all. For the finale, the entire cast paired off and filled the gymnasium stage with frenetic swing dancing as In the Mood blared from the speakers. Skirts flew, feet flashed, football players, now dressed in zoot suits and stingy brim hats, spun limber girls. Most of the latter were cheerleaders who already knew a few things about how to cut a rug. The music ended. The laughing, winded cast stepped forward to take their bows, and as the audience rose to its feet for the third, or maybe it was the fourth time since the curtain went up, Donald started up In the Mood again. This time the boys and girls scampered to opposite sides of the stage, grabbed the dozens of cream pies waiting for them on tables in the wings, and began to pelt each other. The audience roared its approval. This part of the show our cast had known about and looked forward to, although since no actual pies had been flung during rehearsals, I wasn't sure how it would play out. Of course, it went splendidly, as cream pie fights always do. So far as the kids knew, this was the climax. But I had one more trick up my sleeve. As they came forward to take their second bows, faces dripping cream and costumes splattered, In the Mood started up for the third time. Most of the kids looked around puzzled, and so did not see the faculty row rise to its feet holding the cream pies Sadie and I had stashed beneath their seats. The pies flew and the cast was doused for the second time. Coach Borman had two pies and his aim was deadly. He got both his quarterback and his star defenseman. Mike Koslaw, face dripping cream, began to bellow, "Mr. A! Miss D! Mr. A! Miss D!" The rest of the cast took it up, then the audience clapping in rhythm. We went up on stage hand in hand, and Bellingham started that goddamn record yet again. The kids formed lines on either side of us shouting, "Dance! Dance! Dance!" We had no choice, and although I was convinced my girlfriend would go sliding in all that cream and break her neck, we were perfect for the first time since the Sadie Hawkins. At the end of it, I squeezed both of Sadie's hands, saw her little nod, "Go on, go for it, I trust you," and shot her between my legs. Both of her shoes flew into the first row, her skirt skidded deliriously up her thighs, and she came magically to her feet in one piece, with her hands first held out to the audience, which was going insane, and then to the sides of her cream-smeared skirt in a ladylike curtsy. The kids turned out to have a trick up their sleeves as well, one almost certainly instigated by Mike Koslaw, although he would never own up to it. They had saved some pies back, and as we stood there soaking up the applause, we were hit by at least a dozen flying from all directions. "And the crowd, as they say, goes wild." Sadie pulled my ear close to her mouth, wiped whipped cream from it with her pinky and whispered, "How can you leave all this?" And it still wasn't over. Deke and Ellen walked to center stage, finding their way almost magically around the streaks, splatters, and clots of cream. No one would have dreamed of tossing a cream pie at either of them. Deke raised his hands for silence, and when Ellen Dougherty stepped forward, she spoke in a clear classroom voice that carried easily over the murmurs and residual laughter. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight's performance of Jody Jamboree will be followed by three more. This brought another wave of applause. These are benefit performances, Ellie went on when the applause died down. And it pleases me, yes, it pleases me very much, to tell you to whom the benefit will accrue. Last fall, we lost one of our valued students, and we all mourned the passing of Vincent Knowles, which came far, far, far too soon. Now there was dead silence from the audience. A girl you all know, one of the leading lights of our student body, was badly scarred in that accident. Mr. Amberson and Miss Dunhill have arranged for Roberta Jillian Allnut to have facial reconstructive surgery this June in Dallas. There will be no cost to the Allnut family, I'm told by Mr. Sylvester, who has served as the Jody Jamboree accountant, that Bobby Jill's classmates and this town have assured that all the costs of the surgery will be paid in full. There was a moment of quiet as they processed this. Then they leaped to their feet. The applause was like summer thunder. I saw Bobby Jill herself on the bleachers. She was weeping with her hands over her face. Her parents had their arms around her. This was one night in a small town, one of those burgs off the main road that nobody cares about much except for the people who live there. And that's okay, because they care. I looked at Bobby Jill, sobbing into her hands. I looked at Sadie. There was cream in her hair. She smiled. So did I. She mouthed, "I love you, George." I mouthed back, "I love you, too." That night, I loved all of them. And myself, for being with them. I never felt so alive or happy to be alive. How could I leave all this indeed? The blow-up came 2 weeks later. It was a Saturday, grocery day. Sadie and I had gotten into the habit of doing it together at Weingarten's on Highway 77. We'd push our carts companionably side by side while Montovani played overhead, examining the fruit and looking for the best buys on meat. You could get almost any kind of cut you wanted, as long as it was beef or chicken. It was okay with me. Even after nearly 3 years, I was still wowed by the rock-bottom prices. That day I had something other than groceries on my mind. The Hazard family living at 2706 Mercedes. A shotgun shack across the street and a little to the left of the rotting duplex that Lee Oswald would soon call home. Jody Jamboree had kept me very busy, but I'd managed 3 trips back to Mercedes Street that spring. I parked my Ford in a lot in downtown Fort Worth and took the Winscott Road bus, which stopped less than half a mile away. On these trips I dressed in jeans, scuffed boots, and a faded denim jacket I'd picked up at a yard sale. My story, if anyone asked for it, I was looking for a cheap rent because I'd just gotten a night watchman job at Texas Sheet Metal in West Fort Worth. That made me a trustworthy individual, as long as no one checked up, and supplied a reason why the house would be quiet with the shades drawn during the daylight hours. On my strolls up Mercedes Street to the Monkey Ward warehouse and back, always with a newspaper folded open to the rental section of the classifieds, I spotted Mr. Hazard, a hulk in his mid-30s, the 2 kids Rosette wouldn't play with, and an old woman with a frozen face who dragged 1 foot as she walked. Hazard's mama eyed me suspiciously from the mailbox on one occasion as I idled slowly past along the rut that served as a sidewalk, but she didn't speak. On my 3rd recon, I saw a rusty old trailer hooked to the back of Hazard's pickup truck. He and the kids were loading it with boxes while the old lady stood nearby on the just-greening crabgrass, leaning on her cane and wearing a stroke sneer that could have masked any emotion. I was betting on utter indifference. What I felt was happiness. The Hazards were moving on. As soon as they did, a working stiff named George Amberson was going to rent 2706. The important thing was to make sure I was first in line. I was trying to figure out if there was any foolproof way to do that as we went about our Saturday shopping chores. On one level, I was responding to Sadie, making the right comments, kidding her when she spent too much time at the dairy case, pushing the cart loaded with groceries out to the parking lot, putting the bags in the Ford's trunk. But I was doing it all on autopilot, most of my mind worrying over the Fort Worth logistics. And that turned out to be my undoing. I wasn't paying attention to what was coming out of my mouth. And when you're living a double life, that's dangerous. As I drove back to Sadie's place with her sitting quietly, too quietly, beside me, I was singing, because the Ford's radio was on the fritz. The valves had gotten wheezy, too. The Sunliner still looked snappy, and I was attached to it for all sorts of reasons, but it was 7 years downstream from the assembly line, and there were over 90,000 miles on the clock. I carried Sadie's groceries into the kitchen in a single load, making heroic grunting noises and staggering for effect. I didn't notice that she wasn't smiling and had no idea that our little period of greening was over. I was still thinking about Mercedes Street and wondering what kind of a show I'd have to put on there, or rather, how much of a show. It would be delicate. I wanted to be a familiar face because familiarity breeds disinterest as well as contempt, but I didn't want to stand out. Then there were the Oswalds. She didn't speak English, and he was a cold fish by nature, all to the good, but 2706 was still awfully close. The past might be obdurate, but the future was delicate, a house of cards, and I had to be very careful not to change it until I was ready, so I'd have to... That was when Sadie spoke to me, and shortly after that, life, as I had come to know it, and love it, in Jody came crashing down. "George, can you come in the living room? I want to talk to you. Hadn't you better put your hamburger and pork chops in the fridge? And I think I saw ice cream. Let it melt!" she shouted, and that brought me out of my head in a hurry. I turned to her, but she was already in the living room. She picked up her cigarettes from the table beside the couch and lit one. At my gentle urging, she had been trying to cut down, at least around me, and this seemed somehow more ominous than her raised voice. I went into the living room. "What is it, honey? What's wrong?" "Everything." "What was that song?" Her face was pale and set. She held the cigarette in front of her mouth like a shield. I began to realize that I had slipped up, but I didn't know how or when, and that was scary. "I don't know what you're... The song you were singing in the car when we were coming home. The one you were bellowing at the top of your lungs." I tried to remember and couldn't. All I could remember was thinking I'd always have to dress like a slightly down-on-his-luck workman on Mercedes Street so I'd fit in. Sure, I'd been singing, but I often did when I was thinking about other things. Doesn't everybody? Just some pop thing I heard on K-Life, I guess. Something that got into my head. You know how songs do that. I don't understand what's got you so upset. "Something you heard on K-Life. With lyrics like, 'I met a gin-soaked barroom queen in Memphis. She tried to take me upstairs for a ride.'" It wasn't just my heart that sank. Everything below my neck seemed to drop 5 inches. Honky-tonk women. That's what I'd been singing. A song that wouldn't be recorded for another 7 or 8 years by a group that wouldn't even have an American hit for another 3. My mind had been on other things, but still. How could I have been so dumb? "She blew my nose, and then she blew my mind? On the radio? The FCC would shut down a station that played something like that." I started to get angry then, mostly at myself, but not entirely at myself. I was walking a goddamn tightrope, and she was shouting at me over a Rolling Stones tune. "Chill, Sadie, it's just a song. I don't know where I heard it." "That's a lie, and we both know it." "You're freaking out. I think maybe I better take my groceries and head home." I tried to keep my voice calm, The sound of it was very familiar. It was the way I'd always tried to speak to Christy when she came home with a snoot full. Skirt on crooked, blouse half untucked, hair all crazy. Not to mention the smeared lipstick. From the rim of a glass or from some fellow barfly's lips. Just thinking about it made me angrier. Wrong again, I thought. I didn't know if I meant Sadie or Christy or me. At that moment, I didn't care. We never get so mad as when we get caught, do we? I think maybe you better tell me where you heard that song, if you ever want to come back here. And where you heard what you said to the kid at the checkout when he said he'd double-bag your chicken so it wouldn't leak. I don't have any idea. Excellent, dude! That's what you said? I think maybe you better tell me where you heard that. And kick out the jams, and boogie shoes, and shake your booty, chill, and freaking out. I want to know where you heard those, too. Why you say them and no one else does. I want to know why you were so scared of that stupid Jimla chant that you talked about in your sleep. I want to know where Derry is, and why it's like Dallas. I want to know when you were married, and to who, and for how long. I want to know where you were before you were in Florida, because Ellie Dougherty says she doesn't know. That some of your references are fake, appear to be fanciful, is how she put it. I was sure Ellen hadn't found out from Deke, but she had found out. I actually wasn't too surprised, but I was infuriated that she had blabbed to Sadie. She had no right to tell you that. She smashed out her cigarette, then shook her hand as bits of live coal jumped up and stung it. Sometimes it's like you're from, I don't know, some other universe. One where they sing about screwing drunk women from Memphis. I tried to tell myself all that doesn't matter, that love conquers all, except it doesn't. It doesn't conquer lies. Her voice wavered, but she didn't cry, and her eyes stayed fixed on mine. If there had only been anger in them, it would have been a little easier, but there was pleading, too. Sadie, if you'd only... I won't! Not anymore. So don't start up with the stuff about how you're not doing anything you're ashamed of, and I wouldn't be either. Those are things I need to decide for myself. It comes down to this. Either the broom goes, or you'll have to. If you knew you wouldn't, then tell me. I can't. The anger popped like a pricked balloon, leaving an emotional dullness behind. I dropped my eyes from her set face, and they happened to fall on her desk. What I saw there stopped my breath. It was a little pile of job applications for her time in Reno this coming summer. The top one was from Harrah's Hotel and Casino. On the first line, she'd printed her name in neat block letters, her full name, including the middle one I'd never thought to ask her about. I reached down very slowly and put my thumbs over her first name and the second syllable of her last name. What that left was Doris Dunn. I remembered the day I had spoken to Frank Dunning's wife, pretending to be a real estate speculator with an interest in the West Side Rec. She'd been 20 years older than Sadie, Doris, Clayton, nay Dunhill, but both women had blue eyes, exquisite skin, and fine, full-breasted figures. Both women were smokers. All of it could have been coincidental, but it wasn't, and I knew it. "What are you doing?" The accusatory tone meant the real question was, why do you keep dodging and evading? But I was no longer angry, not even close. "Are you sure he doesn't know where you are?" I asked. "Who? Johnny? Do you mean Johnny? Why?" That was when she decided it was useless. I saw it in her face. "George, you need to leave." "But he could find out," I said, "because your parents know, and your parents thought he was just the bee's knees. You said so yourself." I took a step toward her. She took a step back the way you'd step back from a person who's revealed himself to be of unsound mind. I saw the fear in her eyes and the lack of comprehension, and still I couldn't stop. Remember that I was scared myself. Even if you told them not to say, he'd get it out of them because he's charming. Isn't he, Sadie? When he's not compulsively washing his hands or alphabetizing his books or talking about how disgusting it is to get an erection, he's very, very charming. He certainly charmed you. Please go away, George. Her voice was trembling. I took another step toward her instead. She took a compensatory step back, struck the wall, and cringed. Seeing her do that was like a slap across the face to a hysteric, or a glass of cold water flung into the face of a sleepwalker. I retreated to the arch between the living room and the kitchen, my hands held up to the sides of my face like a man surrendering, which was what I was doing. I'm going. But Sadie, I just don't understand how you could do it, she said. The tears had come. They were rolling slowly down her cheeks. Or why you refused to undo it. We had such a good thing. We still do. She shook her head. She did it slowly but firmly. I crossed the kitchen in what felt like a float rather than a walk, plucked the tub of vanilla ice cream from one of the bags standing on the counter, and put it in the freezer of her cold spot. Part of me was thinking this was all just a bad dream and I'd wake up soon. Most of me knew better. Sadie stood in the arch watching me. She had a fresh cigarette in one hand and the job applications in the other. Now that I saw it, the resemblance to Doris Dunning was eerie, which raised the question of why I hadn't seen it before. Because I'd been preoccupied with other stuff? Or was it because I still hadn't fully grasped the immensity of the things I was fooling with? I went out through the screen door and stood on the stoop, looking at her through the mesh. Watch out for him, Sadie. Johnny's mixed up about a lot of things, but he's not dangerous, she said. And my parents would never tell him where I am. They promised. People can break promises and people can snap. Especially people who've been under a lot of pressure and are mentally unstable to begin with. You need to go, George. Promise me that you'll watch out for him, and I will. She shouted, I promise! I promise! I promise! The way her cigarette trembled between her fingers was bad. The combination of shock, loss, grief, and anger in her red eyes was much worse. I could feel them following me all the way back to my car. Goddamned Rolling Stones. Chapter 17. A few days before the end of your testing cycle began, Ellen Dougherty summoned me to her office. After she closed the door, she said, I'm sorry for the trouble I've caused, George. But if I had it to do over again, I'm not sure I would behave any differently. I said nothing. I was no longer angry, but I was still stunned. I'd gotten very little sleep since the blow-up, and I had an idea that 4 a.m. and I were going to be close friends in the near future. Clause 25 of the Texas School Administrative Code, she said, as if that explained everything. I beg your pardon, Ellie? Nina Wallingford was the one who brought it to my attention. Nina was the district nurse. She put tens of thousands of miles on her Ford Ranch wagon each school year, circling Denholm County's 8 schools, 3 of them still of the 1 or 2 room variety. Clause 25 concerns the state's rules for immunization in schools. It covers teachers as well as students, and Nina pointed out she didn't have any immunization records for you. No medical records of any kind, in fact. And there it was, the fake teacher exposed by his lack of a polio shot. Well, at least it wasn't my advanced knowledge of the Rolling Stones or inappropriate use of disco slang. You being so busy with the jamboree and all, I thought I'd write to the schools where you taught and save you the trouble. What I got back from Florida was a letter stating that they don't require immunization records from substitutes. What I got from Maine and Wisconsin was never heard of him. She leaned forward behind her desk, looking at me. I couldn't meet her gaze for long. What I saw in her face before I redirected my gaze to the backs of my hands was an unbearable sympathy. Would the State Board of Education care that we had hired an imposter? Very much. They might even institute legal action to recoup their year's salary. Do I care? Absolutely not. Your work at DCHS has been exemplary. What you and Sadie did for Bobby Jill Allnut was absolutely wonderful. The kind of thing that garners State Teacher of the Year nominations. Thanks, I muttered, I guess. I asked myself what Mimi Corcoran would do. What Memes said to me was if he had signed a contract to teach next year and the year after, you'd be forced to act. But since he's leaving in a month, it's actually in your interest and the school's to say nothing. Then she added, but there's one person who has to know he's not who he says he is. Ellie paused. I told Sadie that I was sure you'd have some reasonable explanation, but it seems you do not. I glanced at my watch. If you're not firing me, Miss Ellie, I ought to get back to my Period 5 class. We're diagramming sentences. I'm thinking of trying them on a compound that goes, I am blameless in this matter, but I cannot say why. What do you think? Too tough? Too tough for me, certainly, she said pleasantly. One thing, I said, Sadie's marriage was difficult. Her husband was strange in ways I don't want to go into. His name is John Clayton. I think he might be dangerous. You need to ask Sadie if she has a picture of him so you'll know what he looks like if he shows up and starts asking questions. And you think this because? Because I've seen something like it before. Will that do? I suppose it will have to, won't it? That wasn't a good enough answer. Will you ask her? Yes, George. She might mean it. She might only be humoring me. I couldn't tell. I was at the door when she said, as if only passing the time of day, you're breaking that young woman's heart. I know, I said, and left. Mercedes Street, late May. Welder, are you? I was standing on the porch of 2706 with the landlord, a fine American named Mr. J. Baker. He was stocky, with a huge gut he called the house that Shiner built. We had just finished a quick tour of the premises, which Baker had explained to me was prime to the bus stop, as if that made up for the sagging ceilings, water-stained walls, cracked toilet tank, and general air of decrepitude. Night watchman, I said. Yeah, that's a good job. Plenty of time to fuck the dog on a job like that. This seemed to require no response. No wife or kiddies? Divorced, they're back east. Pay hellimony, do you? I shrugged. He let it go. So, do you want the place, Amberson? I guess so, I said and sighed. He took a long rent book with a floppy leather cover out of his back pocket. First month, last month, damage deposit. Damage deposit? You have to be kidding. Baker went on as if he hadn't heard me. Rent's due on the last Friday of the month. Come up short or late, and you're on the street, courtesy of Fort Worth PD. Me and them get along real good. He took the charred cigar stub from his breast pocket, stuck the chewed end in his gob, and popped a wooden match alight with his thumbnail. It was hot on the porch. I had an idea it was going to be a long, hot summer. I sighed again. Then, with a show of reluctance, I took out my wallet and began to remove $20 bills. "In God we trust," I said. "All others pay cash." He laughed, puffing out clouds of acrid blue smoke as he did so.
"That's good. I'll remember that.
Especially on the last Friday of the month." I couldn't believe I was going to live in this desperate shack and on this desperate street after my nice house south of here, where I'd taken pride in keeping an actual lawn mowed. Although I hadn't even left Jody yet, I felt a wave of homesickness. "Give me a receipt, please," I said. That much I got for free. It was the last day of school. The classrooms and hallways were empty. The overhead fans paddled air that was already hot, although it was only the 8th of June. The Oswald family had left Russia. In another 5 days, according to Al Templeton's notes, the SS Mazdam would dock in Hoboken, where they would walk down the gangplank and onto United States soil. The teacher's room was empty except for Danny Laverty.
"Hey, champ, understand you're going off to Dallas to finish that book of yours."
"That's the plan." Fort Worth was actually the plan, at least to begin with. I began cleaning out my pigeonhole, which was stuffed with end-of-school communiques.
"If I was footloose and fancy free instead of tied down to a wife, three rugrats, and a mortgage, I might try a book myself," Danny said. "I was in the war, you know."
I knew. Everyone knew, usually within 10 minutes of meeting him.
"Got enough to live on?"
"I'll be okay." I had more than enough to take me through to next April, when I expected to conclude my business with Lee Oswald. I wouldn't need to make any more expeditions to Faith Financial on Greenville Avenue. Going there even once had been incredibly stupid. If I wanted, I could try to tell myself that what had happened to my place in Florida had just been the result of a prank gone bad, but I'd also tried to tell myself that Sadie and I were doing fine, and look how that had turned out. I tossed the wad of paperwork from my pigeonhole into the trash and saw a small sealed envelope I had somehow missed. I knew who used envelopes like that. There was no salutation on the sheet of notepaper inside and no signature except for the faint, perhaps even illusory, scent of her perfume. The message was brief. "Thank you for showing me how good things can be. Please don't say goodbye." I held it for a minute, thinking, then stuck it in my back pocket and walked rapidly down to the library. I don't know what I planned to do or what I meant to tell her, but none of it mattered because the library was dark and the chairs were up on the tables. I tried the knob anyway, but the door was locked. The only two cars left at the faculty end of the parking lot were Danny Laverty's Plymouth sedan and my Ford. The ragtop now looked rather raggedy. I could sympathize. I felt a bit raggedy myself.
"Mr. A! Wait up, Mr. A!"
It was Mike and Bobby Jill hurrying across the hot parking lot toward me. Mike was carrying a small wrapped present, which he held out to me.
"Bobby and me got you something."
"Bobby and I. And you shouldn't have, Mike."
"We had to, man."
I was moved to see that Bobby Jill was crying and pleased to see that the thick coating of Max Factor had disappeared from her face. Now that she knew the disfiguring scar's days were numbered, she had stopped trying to conceal it. She kissed me on the cheek.
"Thank you so, so, so much, Mr. Amberson. I'll never forget you."
She looked at Mike.
"We'll never forget you."
And they probably wouldn't. That was a good thing. It didn't make up for the locked and dark library, but yes, it was a very good thing.
"Open it," Mike said. "We hope you like it. It's for your book."
I opened the package. Inside was a wooden box about 8 inches long and 2 inches wide. Inside the box, cradled in silk, was a Waterman fountain pen with the initials G.A. engraved on the clip. "Oh, Mike," I said, "this is too much." "It wouldn't be enough if it was solid gold," he said. "You changed my life." He looked at Bobby. "Both our lives." "Mike," I said, "it was my pleasure." He hugged me, and in 1962, that is not a cheap gesture between men. I was glad to hug him back. "You stay in touch," Bobby Jill said. "Dallas ain't far." She paused. "Isn't." "I will," I said, but I wouldn't, and they probably wouldn't either. They were going off into their lives, and if they were lucky, their lives would shine. They started away, then Bobby turned back. "It's a shame you two broke up. It makes me feel real bad." "It makes me feel bad, too," I said. "But it's probably for the best." I headed home to pack up my typewriter and my other belongings, which I reckoned were still few enough to fit into no more than a suitcase and a few cardboard boxes. At the one stoplight on Main Street, I opened the little box and looked at the pen. It was a beautiful thing, and I was very touched that they had given it to me. I was even more touched that they had waited to say goodbye. The light turned green. I snapped the lid of the box closed and drove on. There was a lump in my throat, but my eyes were dry. Living on Mercedes Street was not an uplifting experience. Days weren't so bad. They resounded with the shouts of children recently released from school, all dressed in two big hand-me-downs. Housewives kvetching at mailboxes or backyard clotheslines. Teenagers driving rusty beaters with glass-packed mufflers and radios blaring K-Life. The hours between 2 and 6 a.m. weren't so bad either. Then a kind of stunned silence fell over the street as colicky babies finally slept in their cribs or dresser drawers, and their daddies snored toward another day of hourly wages in the shops, factories, or outlying farms. Between 4 and 6 in the afternoon, however, the street was a jangle of mamas screaming at kids to get the hell in and do their chores, and papas arriving home to scream at their wives, probably because they had no one else to scream at. Many of the wives gave back as good as they got. The drunk-a-daddies started to roll in around 8, and things really got noisy around 11, when either the bars closed or the money ran out. Then I heard slamming doors, breaking glass, and screams of pain as some loaded drunk-a-daddy tuned up on the wife, the kiddies, or both. Often red lights would strobe in through my drawn curtains as the cops arrived. A couple of times there were gunshots, maybe fired at the sky, maybe not. And one early morning, when I went out to get the paper, I saw a woman with dried blood crusting the lower half of her face. She was sitting on the curb in front of a house 4 down from mine, drinking a can of Lone Star. I almost went down to check on her, even though I knew how unwise it would be to get involved with the life of this low-bottom working neighborhood. Then she saw me looking at her and hoisted her middle finger. I went back inside. There was no welcome wagon, and no women named Muffy or Buffy trotting off to junior league meetings. What there was on Mercedes Street was plenty of time to think. Time to miss my friends and Jody. Time to miss the work that had kept my mind off what I'd come here to do. Time to realize the teaching had done a lot more than pass the time. It had satisfied my mind the way work does when you care about it, when you feel like you might actually be making a difference. There was even time to feel bad about my formerly spiffy convertible. Besides the non-functional radio and the wheezy valves, it now blatted and backfired through a rusty tailpipe, and there was a crack in the windshield caused by a rock that had bounced off the back of a lumbering asphalt truck. I'd stopped washing it, and now, sad to say, it fit in perfectly with the other busted-up transpo on Mercedes Street. Mostly, there was time to think about Sadie. "You're breaking that young woman's heart," Ellie Dougherty had said. "And mine wasn't doing so well either." The idea of spilling everything to Sadie came to me one night as I lay awake listening to a drunken argument next door. "You did." "I didn't." "You did." "I didn't." "Fuck you." I rejected the idea, but it came back the following night, rejuvenated. I could see myself sitting with her at her kitchen table, drinking coffee in the strong afternoon sunlight that slanted through the window over the sink, speaking calmly, telling her my real name was Jacob Epping. I wouldn't actually be born for another 14 years. I had come from the year 2011 via a fissure in time that my late friend Al Templeton called the rabbit hole. How would I convince her of such a thing? By telling her that a certain American defector who had changed his mind about Russia was shortly going to move in across the street from where I now lived, along with his Russian wife and their baby girl? By telling her that the Dallas Texans, not yet the Cowboys, not yet America's team, were going to beat the Houston Oilers 20-17 this fall in double overtime? Ridiculous. But what else did I know about the immediate future? Not much, because I'd had no time to study up. I knew a fair amount about Oswald, but that was all. She'd think I was crazy. I could sing her lyrics from another dozen pop songs that hadn't been recorded yet, and she'd still think I was crazy. She'd accuse me of making them up myself. Wasn't I a writer, after all? And suppose she did believe it. Did I want to drag her into the shark's mouth with me? Wasn't it bad enough that she'd be coming back to Jody in August, and that if John Clayton was an echo of Frank Dunning, he might come looking for her? "All right, get out then," a woman screamed from the street, and a car accelerated away in the direction of Winscott Road. A wedge of light probed briefly through a crack in my drawn curtains and flashed across the ceiling. "Cocksucker!" she yelled after it, to which a male voice, a little more distant, yelled back, "You can suck mine, lady. Maybe it'll calm you down." That was life on Mercedes Street in the summer of 62. "Leave her out of it." That was the voice of reason. "It's just too dangerous. Maybe at some point she can be part of your life again, a life in Jody even, but not now." Only, there was never going to be a life for me in Jody. Given what Ellen now knew about my past, teaching at the high school was a fool's dream. And what else was I going to do, pour concrete? One morning I put on the coffee pot and went for the paper on the stoop. When I opened the front door, I saw that both of the Sunliner's rear tires were flat. Some bored-out-too-late kid had slashed them with a knife. That was also life on Mercedes Street in the summer of 62. On Thursday, the 14th of June, I dressed in jeans, a blue work shirt, and an old leather vest I'd picked up at a second-hand store on Camp Bowie Road. Then I spent the morning pacing through my house. I had no television, but I listened to the radio. According to the news, President Kennedy was planning a state trip to Mexico later in the month. The weather report called for fair skies and warm temperatures. The DJ yammered a while, then played Palisades Park. The screams and roller coaster sound effects on the record clawed at my head. At last I could stand it no longer. I was going to be early. But I didn't care. I got into the Sunliner, which now sported two retread black walls to go with the white walls on the front, and drove the 40-odd miles to Love Field in northwest Dallas. There was no short-term or long-term parking, just parking. It cost 75 cents a day. I clapped my old summer straw on my head and trudged approximately half a mile to the terminal building. A couple of Dallas cops stood at the curb drinking coffee, but there were no security guards inside and no metal detectors to walk through. Passengers simply showed their tickets to a guy standing by the door. then walked across the hot tarmac to planes belonging to one of five carriers, American, Delta, TWA, Frontier, and Texas Airways. I checked the chalkboard mounted on the wall behind the Delta counter. It said that Flight 194 was on time. When I asked the clerk to make sure, she smiled and told me it had just left Atlanta. "But you're awfully early." "I can't help it," I said. "I'll probably be early to my own funeral." She laughed and wished me a nice day. I bought a time and walked across to the restaurant where I ordered the Cloud 9 Chef's Salad. It was huge, and I was too nervous to be hungry. It's not every day that a man gets to see the person who's going to change world history. But it gave me something to pick at while I waited for the plane carrying the Oswald family to arrive. I was in a booth with a good view of the main terminal. It wasn't very crowded, and a young woman in a dark blue traveling suit caught my eye. Her hair was twisted into a neat bun. She had a suitcase in each hand. A Negro porter approached her. She shook her head, smiling, then banged her arm on the side of the traveler's aid booth as she passed it. She dropped one of her suitcases, rubbed her elbow, then picked up the case again and forged onward. Sadie, leaving to start her 6-week residency in Reno. Was I surprised? Not at all. It was that convergence thing again. I'd grown used to it. Was I almost overwhelmed by an impulse to run out of the restaurant and catch up to her before it was too late? Of course I was. For a moment it seemed more than possible. It seemed necessary. I'd tell her fate, rather than some weird time travel harmonic, had brought us together at the airport. Stuff like that worked in the movies, didn't it? I'd asked her to wait while I bought my own ticket to Reno, and tell her that once we were there, I'd explain everything. And after the obligatory 6 weeks, we could buy a drink for the judge who had granted her divorce before he married us. I actually started to get up. As I did, I happened to look at the cover of the Time I'd bought at the newsstand. Jacqueline Kennedy was on the cover. She was smiling, radiant, wearing a sleeveless dress with a V-neck. "The President's Lady Dresses for Summer," the caption read. As I looked at the photo, the color drained away to black and white, and the expression changed from a happy smile to a vacant stare. Now she was standing next to Lyndon Johnson on Air Force One and no longer wearing the pretty and slightly sexy summer dress. A blood-spattered wool suit had taken its place. I remembered reading, not in Al's notes, somewhere else, that not long after Mrs. Kennedy's husband had been pronounced dead, Lady Bird Johnson had moved to embrace her in the hospital corridor and had seen a glob of the dead president's brains on that suit. A headshot president, and all the dead who would come after standing behind him in a ghostly file that stretched away into infinity. I sat back down again and watched Sadie carry her suitcases toward the Frontier Airlines counter. The bags were obviously heavy, but she carried them con brio, her back straight, her low heels clicking briskly. The clerk checked them and put them on a baggage trolley. He and Sadie conferred. She passed him the ticket she had bought through a travel agency 2 months ago, and the clerk scribbled something on it. She took it back and turned for the gate. I lowered my head to make sure she wouldn't see me. When I looked up again, she was gone. 40 long, long minutes later, a man, a woman, and 2 small children, a boy and a girl, passed the restaurant. The boy was holding his father's hand and chattering away. The father was looking down at him, nodding and smiling. The father was Robert Oswald. The loudspeakers blared, "Delta's Flight 194 is now arriving from Newark and Atlanta Municipal Airport. Passengers can be met at Gate 4. Delta Flight 194 now arriving." Robert's wife, Veda, according to Al's notes, swept the little girl into her arms and hurried along faster. There was no sign of Marguerite. I picked at my salad, chewing without tasting. My heart was beating hard. I could hear the approaching roar of engines and saw the white nose of a DC-8 as it pulled up to the gate. Greeters piled up around the door. A waitress tapped me on the shoulder, and I almost screamed. "Sorry, sir," she said in a Texas accent that was thick enough to cut. "Just wanted to ask if I could get you all anything else." "No," I said, "I'm fine." "Well, that's good." The first passengers began cutting across the terminal. They were all men wearing suits and prosperous haircuts, of course. The first passengers to deplane were always from first class. "Sure I can't get you a piece of peach pie? It's fresh today." "No, thanks." "You sure, hon?" Now the coach class passengers came in a flood, all of them festooned with carry-on bags. I heard a woman squeal. Was that Veda greeting her brother-in-law? "I'm sure," I said, and picked up my magazine. She took the hint. I sat stirring the remains of my salad into an orange soup of French dressing and watched. Here came a man and woman with a baby, but the kid was almost a toddler, too old to be June. The passengers passed the restaurant, chattering with the friends and relatives who had come to pick them up. I saw a young man in an army uniform pat his girlfriend's bottom. She laughed, slapped his hand, and stood on tiptoe to kiss him. For 5 minutes or so, the terminal was almost full. Then the crowd began to thin out. There was no sign of the Oswalds. A wild certainty came to me. They weren't on the plane. I hadn't just traveled back in time. I had bounced into some sort of parallel universe. Maybe the yellow card man had been meant to stop something like that from happening, but the yellow card man was dead. And I was off the hook. No Oswald? Fine. No mission. Kennedy was going to die in some other version of America, but not in this one. I could catch up with Sadie and live happily ever after. The thought had no more than crossed my mind when I saw my target for the first time. Robert and Lee were side by side talking animatedly. Lee was swinging what was either an oversized attaché case or a small satchel. Robert had a pink suitcase with rounded corners that looked like something out of Barbie's closet. Veda and Marina came along behind. Veda had taken one of the two patchwork cloth bags. Marina had the other slung over her shoulder. She was also carrying June, now 4 months old, in her arms, and laboring to keep up. Robert and Veda's two kids flanked her, looking at her with open curiosity. Veda called to the men, and they stopped almost in front of the restaurant. Robert grinned and took Marina's carry bag. Lee's expression was amused, knowing, maybe both. The tiniest suggestion of a smile dimpled the corners of his mouth. His nondescript hair was neatly combed. He was, in fact, the perfect AJ squared away in his pressed white shirt, khakis, and shined shoes. He didn't look like a man who had just completed a journey halfway around the world. There wasn't a wrinkle on him, and not a trace of beard shadow on his cheeks. He was just 22 years old and looked younger, like one of the teenagers in my last American Lit class. So did Marina, who wouldn't be old enough to buy a legal drink for another month. She was exhausted, bewildered, and staring at everything. She was also beautiful, with clouds of dark hair and upturned, somehow rueful, blue eyes. June's arms and legs were swaddled in cloth diapers. Even her neck was wrapped in something, and although she wasn't crying, her face was red and sweaty. Lee took the baby. Marina smiled her gratitude, and when her lips parted, I saw that one of her teeth was missing. The others were discolored, one of them almost black. The contrast with her creamy skin and gorgeous eyes was jarring.